The death toll from the recent earthquakes in Turkey and Syria exceeds 21,000 as search and rescue operations continue. Tehran strongly condemns the latest U.S. sanctions on its petrochemical companies, saying they prove Washington's ill will and hypocrisy toward Iran. Also ahead, the Russian president says his country's economy has overcome the adverse impact of Western sanctions and is expected to show modest growth in 2023. Welcome to World News. We're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story: in Syria and Turkey, thousands of locals and foreigners continue the rescue operation for more survivors, despite dimming hopes 4 days after a massive quake, which is the sixth deadliest in the century. The scale of the natural disaster has swamped relief operations, already hampered by freezing temperatures. Chances of finding survivors have dimmed now that the 72-hour mark experts consider the most likely period to save lives has passed. The death toll stands at over 21,000, of which more than 17,000 is for Turkey and over 3,000 in Syria. Experts fear the number will continue to rise sharply as thousands of buildings have been flattened. Dozens of nations, including China and the United States, have pledged to help. Search teams and relief supplies have already arrived. Iran has called for more international aid for the quake-hit regions in Syria and Turkey, especially those parts of Syria that are not controlled by the government. Foreign Minister Hossein Emir Abdullahian made the remarks in a phone call with the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. He said the situation in Syria's Idlib province is especially tragic because the government has no access to that region. Emir Abdullahian said Iran is ready to dispatch search and rescue teams to Idlib. Guterres, for his part, said the world body will do its utmost to help the quake victims, including in Syria. He added that the UN considers helping the Syrian people a totally humanitarian issue.
A devastating 7.8 magnitude earthquake struck southeastern Turkey and northwestern Syria early on Monday. The deadly quake and a string of aftershocks have killed thousands of people in both countries and injured more. Hundreds of buildings in both Syria and Turkey have been reduced to rubble. Rescue workers are still working in freezing temperatures to find those still trapped under debris. While Turkey has been aided by its allies and Western partners to cope with the crisis, aid is trickling to sanctions-hit Syria. Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad has highlighted Syria's need for humanitarian assistance, warning that the US sanctions have worsened the circumstances as the illegal bans have prevented the delivery of everything to the country. The catastrophe of the earthquake that struck Syria is great, and what has increased its depth is the difficult circumstances that the country has been going through for the past 12 years as it's fighting terrorism and its supporters. What exacerbated the tragedy and catastrophe was the sanctions imposed by the United States and Western countries on Syria. The Syrian top diplomat further said that Damascus had appealed to the member states of the United Nations, the General Secretariat of the organization, its relevant agencies and funds, the International Committee of the Red Cross, and other humanitarian action partners from international, governmental and non-governmental organizations to extend a helping hand and support Syria's efforts to confront the crisis.
You know, given that the war situation and economic, financial, illegal, inhumane Western sanctions imposed on Syria, at the same time when the U.S. Is imposing, and with its Western allies, imposing almost a blockade around Syria.
Well,
calls are now growing louder on Western nations to lift their sanctions on Syria in a bid to expedite rescue operations. The Syrian Red Crescent has appealed to Western countries to provide aid to help the Arab country deal with the aftermath of the devastating earthquakes. Syria is also grappling with the years of foreign-backed insurgency, militancy, terrorism, which has devastated the country.
As Syria is reeling from the aftermath of the deadly earthquakes, the United States is working with partners to provide earthquake relief in Syria, but will stand firm against working with Syria's legitimate government headed by President Bashar al-Assad. The United States has refused normalization of relations with the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad or any direct reconstruction aid.
Lots of the airplane, cargo airplane, refused to land on Syrian airports because of the American and European sanctions. So even those countries who want to send humanitarian assistance, they cannot use the airplane cargo because of the sanctions.
Washington listed Syria as a state sponsor of terrorism in 1979, but since the beginning of the imposed war on Syria in 2011, the United States and its Western allies have imposed a number of economic sanctions and restrictions on Syria. U.S. sanctions intensified with the passing of the CESAR Act in 2019, which was signed by former President Donald Trump. The sanctions have severely affected the Syrian economy, especially its construction, finance and energy sectors, and complicated the reconstruction effort.
The hurdles we have, if I talk about the area under government control, we don't have an access problem in terms of authorizations, but we have an access problem in terms of the capacity of the infrastructure to authorize that, to enable us to do it. I mean, this means we might have to repair a few roads here and there. And we're not the only one. The government is also working on that. But we are in a situation where it was already difficult to do that before. And now we are in a situation where we don't have any other option than doing it.
Syria has been in the throes of foreign-backed militancy since March 2011. While the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group was crushed by the Syrian government, militant outfits continue to hold sway in some parts of the country under the patronage of Western powers. The United States has also established several military bases in northern Syria in a bid to help the terrorists there. Meanwhile, Iran has sent several batches of humanitarian aid to Syria to help the Arab country deal with the aftermath of the devastating earthquakes. The latest batch of aid included food, blankets, and carpets. Iran will send more humanitarian supplies to Syria in the coming days. Iran has urged the international community to put pressure on the US to lift its cruel sanctions on Syria to facilitate aid deliveries. The Lebanese Hezbollah resistance movement has also sent convoys of humanitarian aid to earthquake-affected areas in Syria.
Tunisian President Kais Saied has decided to restore full diplomatic ties with Syria after a decade of tense relations. The announcement was made in a statement by Saied's office. The presidency said relations with Syria will be upgraded to ambassador level. Tunis cut off diplomatic relations with Damascus after foreign-backed militancy started in Syria in 2011. Later, in 2017, Tunisia reinstituted a limited diplomatic mission to Syria. Many Arab countries have indicated their decision to restore ties with Syria after the country's forces effectively defeated foreign-backed militants and terrorists. Egypt, Jordan, Oman, and the United Arab Emirates have already taken steps to mend fences with Damascus. Iran's ambassador to Moscow says Tehran will take part in trilateral talks on the settlement of differences between Damascus and Ankara. Kazem Jalali made the remark while talking to Russian media in Moscow. He hoped that Iran's participation in the talks among Syria, Turkey, and Russia would take place before the upcoming foreign ministerial meeting. Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan recently said the foreign ministers of Syria, Turkey, and Russia will meet to address existing differences between Damascus and Ankara. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has also called Iran's participation in the talks reasonable. And Iran has strongly condemned new U.S. sanctions on a number of petrochemical companies, saying President Joe Biden continues the failed policy of his predecessor. The foreign ministry spokesman said the U.S. recourse to illegal and unilateral sanctions proves the legitimacy of Tehran's position and Washington's ill will and hypocrisy towards Iran. Nasser Kanani added that the imposition of unilateral coercive measures contravenes the accepted norms and principles of international law. He said Iran reserves the right to take all necessary measures to counter U.S. sanctions. Earlier on Thursday, the U.S. Treasury Department said it had imposed sanctions on six Iran-based petrochemical manufacturers and their subsidiaries, as well as three firms in Malaysia and Singapore. The Treasury accused those companies of helping Iran sell its petrochemicals and petroleum to Asian buyers. Iran says despite U.S. sanctions, the country's oil exports hit new highs in the last 2 months of 2022. Iranian and Russian TV channels are set to boost bilateral cooperation in a meeting with the head of the IRIB World Service. A delegation of Russian television executives discussed practical measures to strengthen partnership. Gisu Mishahmedi has the details.
In line with the fourth meeting of Iran and Russia media cooperation, a delegation of Russian television executives, as well as TV and radio station managers, led by the Russian Deputy Minister of Digital Affairs, visited the IRIB World Service's TV and radio stations. That included the Spanish channel Hispan TV and the English news network Press TV, a chance for the Russian delegation to observe the technical developments up close.
Both the Russian and the Iranian side have reached a point where they are ready for practical steps after holding several rounds of meetings and signing cooperation agreements. We have laid the groundwork, and our audience will soon be enjoying our joint TV and radio productions.
The visit also provided the opportunity to discuss potential areas of cooperation.
We can cooperate in exchange of content. It's movies, TV series, it's cartoons and documentaries. There is a very broad field.
The details were carefully discussed in order to break down the steps and see how the two sides can take cooperation to the next level. First and foremost, representatives were appointed from both sides to be directly in touch and to be in charge of joint media productions from now on.
Iran and Russia are both under pressure and sanctions by Western countries, so this meeting and the one we had 2 days ago are of strategic importance. There is great potential, and I believe that we can immediately begin joint radio production.
But the highlight of this meeting was how to neutralize Western sanctions, particularly in the field of media, with the Iranian side sharing its valuable experiences in this regard.
We are witnessing a new world order, and under these circumstances, regional and international powers such as Russia, Iran, and China will be growing closer and develop stronger alliances. Russians are experiencing sanctions aimed at isolating them since the war in Ukraine has begun. We can share years of experience with them in this regard. Our media cooperation not only allows unheard voices to be heard, but it will also reshape public opinion.
Both sides agree that the groundwork has prepared and joint production can start in 2023, marking the beginning of a strategic alliance in a multipolar world where all voices can be heard. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
Turning elsewhere now, the Russian president says his country's economy has overcome the adverse impact of Western sanctions that were imposed on Moscow over the war in Ukraine.
I think that for many of those who were and are trying to create problems, it was unexpected how effectively we withstood the threats created for us in economy and in particular industries. As it became evident, the financial system is working, all of the production industries are working, all services, they work at pace without failures.
Vladimir Putin said that despite attempts to undermine certain Russian industries, the country's economy is expected to show modest growth in 2023. He added that international institutes have to acknowledge that Moscow has successfully coped with the shocks of the sanctions. After the war began in Ukraine, Russia was slapped with a slew of sanctions by Kiev's allies. The sanctions cut Russian banks from the SWIFT financial network, curbed the country's access to technology, and restricted its oil exports. Moscow says its economy is resilient and the sanctions have boomeranged against the West by driving up inflation and energy prices. The Chilean government has declared a nighttime curfew in south-central regions where wildfires have raged for over a week now. The curfew will be enforced from midnight to 5 a.m. local time on Friday. It will cover 28 municipalities in three regions hit worst by forest fires. Officials say the move is aimed at preventing theft and looting in the affected regions. Some 5,600 firefighters are currently battling 90 priority fires out of 323 still active. The wildfires have so far scorched 300,000 hectares of forest and destroyed 1,200 houses, leaving thousands of people homeless. They have left at least 24 people dead and over 2,000 injured. About 20 people have been arrested on suspicion of having set some of the fires.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
Imam Khomeini, God's righteous servant. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, these days mark the 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. We have prepared a special series on this occasion. This episode will be a brief look at Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, as the great leader of this revolution. Stay tuned, please. Imam Khomeini had been sent to exile for more than 14 years due to his struggles against the British-installed and American-supported Pahlavi regime. The imam was sent clandestinely to Turkey in 1964. After some 10 months, he was transferred to the holy city of Najaf in Iraq. The imam stayed in Najaf for more than 13 years, till the increase of pressures by the Shah of Iran, which forced him to change his residence from Iraq to the village of Neuf-le-Château near Paris. On February 1, 1979, Imam Khomeini's airplane took off toward Tehran. At time of entering Iran's air, a journalist asked the imam how he felt. Imam Khomeini answered indifferently, "Nothing." Unlike the leaders of uprisings and revolutions who rejoice for triumph over their enemies, the imam said nothing, as he had acted according to his duty and for God's sake. So he would not get sad if he failed, and he didn't become happy when he triumphed. On February 1, 1979, the greatest and most glorious welcome in history was accorded to Imam Khomeini. The axis of victory of the Islamic Revolution was surely the unmatched leader who was ably and powerfully guided the nation better than any politician in the world. While religion had been quite isolated and pushed to the margin, Imam Khomeini followed the method of the Prophet of Islam and his infallible successors to liberate a nation from the yoke of colonialists and bullies of the world. He awakened the nation and granted self-esteem, self-confidence, and identity to them and other Muslim nations. The Imam presented a new system of governance on the basis of Islam within the structure of people's vote. Here, it should be noted that people's vote played a true role in Imam's view, opposite to the flawed and backward Western democracy, which only pretends to act on the basis of people's vote, while in practice, it is at the service of the owners of power. Imam Khomeini's successor, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, describes the Imam as follows. One of the titles and epithets which have been used less about our great Imam is this phrase. We always describe the Imam with numerous epithets, but this epithet, which we have described him rarely with it, is a comprehensive epithet. He is faithful, submissive servant, and revolutionary. Faithful means that he has faith in God. He has faith in the goal. He has faith in the path that takes him to this goal. And he has faith in people. It has been mentioned in the Quran about the noble prophet too. He had faith in God. Faith in the goal, faith in the path, and faith in people. He is a servant, a submissive servant. It means that he considers himself a servant before the Lord. This is a very important epithet. Look, God, the Exalted, has praised the noble prophet with numerous epithets in the Quran, each of which mentions an ample chapter of the Prophet's characteristics. But the epithet which we Muslims have been ordered to repeat every day in our daily ritual prayers on the Prophet is this: I bear witness that indeed Muhammad is his servant, an apostle. This indicates the importance of servitude. Being a servant is so prominent that God the Exalted teaches Muslims this epithet to repeat it several times in their prayers every day. The Imam had such an epithet, the epithet of servitude. He was a man of humbleness. He was a man of pleading humbly. And he was a man of praying, a submissive servant. And as for the third epithet, that is revolutionary, the Imam was the Imam of the Revolution. Imam Khomeini enjoyed a comprehensive godly personality. Therefore, upon his splendid return to the country, he opened new vistas of Islam before the contemporary man and presented Islam as a progressive religion which is capable of meeting all the demands of man in the modern world. The Iranian people had truly found their beliefs and ideals in his words and deeds. Therefore, they unanimously gathered around him. Imam Khomeini raised pure Muhammadan Islam as the new view on Islam, which includes every political, economic, cultural, and social aspect in human life. His take of Islam is a religion which fights the world oppressors and bullies in support for the oppressed and downtrodden in every country. The great leader of the Islamic Revolution believed that the way to the hereafter goes through this world. For him, both individual and social affairs mattered in order to help the individual and society grow. The Imam would never forget midnight prayer even when he was sick. On the night of flying to Tehran from Paris, while everyone was asleep, Imam Khomeini was performing midnight prayer on the upper floor of the airplane. Ayatollah Khamenei says, "What enabled the Imam to guide, administer, and lead this nation and this great revolution was his relation with God, his connection with God, his attention to God. He was truly God's servant, righteous servant. I cannot find a better epithet than this for Imam. He was a righteous servant."
Food for thought.
Hello, dear listeners, and for your information, once when the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, was asked about the best and the worst creations of God, he answered, "Worthing is the best and the worst thing that God created. By means of worthing, some faces become white, and by means of wording, some faces become black."
IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Action Acceptance Criteria. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of the action acceptance criteria in the Islamic lifestyle. We know that every Muslim, being a Muslim, we are worried about the acceptance of our actions that we perform. And there must be some criteria, obviously, when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has created us, when He has guided us to the right path. There is a criteria which is set by God that on this criteria, He will accept our deeds, our actions. And we must know about the criteria. And if we are unaware of the criteria and we keep performing things, then obviously we are wasting our times. It is necessary to know that what is the main criteria through which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will accept our deeds. And it is said clearly in the Quran, Allah has said in chapter 5, verse 27, that إِنَّمَا يَتَقَبَّلُ اللَّهُ مِنَ الْمُتَّقِينَ. Innama means certainly only, certainly only. Yataqabbalullah, Allah accepts minal muttaqeen, He accepts from the muttaqeen, those who God fear. Therefore, taqwa is the main criteria of the acceptance of a'mal, the acceptance of the deeds. And if a person does not disobey Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, then obviously his actions are accepted. And this means that when we should not disobey Allah purposefully, we should not disobey Allah intentionally. Maybe someone has performed something unintentionally, or maybe he was unaware of it, and therefore Allah has opened the door of tawbah, He has opened the door of astaghfar, He has opened the door of ignorance, that because he was ignorant towards such thing, then obviously he can accept. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of the action acceptance criteria in the Islamic lifestyle. And we said that obviously Allah will accept only from those who are muttaqeen, who have taqwa, who are God-fearing. And if someone is performing something with the ignorance, if he is unintentionally performing something, then obviously Allah will accept it because he was unaware of that. Therefore, we must live a life in which we do not disobey Allah purposefully. We do not disobey Allah with intention, because if it is with intention, that we know that this is a specific thing, it's a specific sin. And by knowing that this is a sin and then we perform, then God forbids us. He might not accept that. And that's why in the Quran, He has clearly said, certainly only He accepts from the muttaqeen, from the God-fearing ones, from those who perform things without disobeying Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And on the other hand, Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam has also said, لَا يَقِلُّ عَمَلٌ مَعَ التَّقْوَى. None of the actions are, they're taken small if they are accompanied with the taqwa, with the taqwa. وَكَيْفُ يَقِلُّ مَا يُتَقَبَّلُ. And how can Allah make something smaller if He is accepting, His criteria of acceptance is that thing? Because in the verse of the Quran, Allah said the criteria of acceptance is taqwa. Therefore, we must perform things with the taqwa. We must live a life in which we can have taqwa so that Allah accepts our a'mal, our deeds. Therefore, it is necessary to be God-wary in our daily life so that our actions are accepted by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
With mounting food, energy, and housing costs, UK household budgets are becoming increasingly stretched. And as the cost of living crisis worsens, vulnerable families and their children are being pushed to the edge.
People are struggling to eat. People are struggling to heat their homes as well. That has a knock-on effect in terms of general health and well-being. So we get more people that turn up at accidents in emergency, more people that might be using drugs and alcohol to alleviate the symptoms caused by the poverty that they're feeling.
Around 13.4 million people were living in poverty in the UK between 2020 and 2021, according to the Joseph Rowntree Foundation. Analysis from the foundation has revealed 3.9 million children were living in poverty in the UK in the same period of time.
We regularly have people who come in that may not have eaten for 2-3 days. We didn't used to see that before. I also had a family where one night they fed the son, the next night they fed the daughter because they can't feed everyone. I just think it's shameful that we're in a relatively wealthy city that we have people that are struggling so, so much.
Child poverty increased most dramatically in the northeast of England between 2015 and 2020, rising by over a third, from 26% to 37% of all children. Demand for free school meals is also highest in the Northeast, where around 29.1% of children currently qualify, compared to just 17.6% in the Southeast.
We all know inflation's going up, by a lot, but
it's people that are on the lowest incomes that will suffer the most, because the products that they're buying to basic food isn't just going up by 10% or whatever, it's going up by 100%.
But while the Northeast now has the highest rate of child poverty across the regions, many of the worst affected constituencies and local authorities continue to be in London, according to Action for Children. This is due to high housing costs in the capital. The Childhood Trust has found 40% of children aged 6 to 16 are facing food poverty in London, meaning their families cannot afford to keep them fed.
In a city like London, one of the most thriving cities in the world, it's shocking. It's shocking to think that that number of children and our families are struggling to make ends meet and are struggling to provide the food that they need for their families. It's really quite a shocking statistic, I think.
In the words of Lawrence Guinness, Childhood Trust chief executive, we've never seen levels of food insecurity at that high before. It's an alarm bell in the face of growing adversity and the diminishing power of household income. Tower Hamlets is the borough with the highest rate of child poverty after housing costs, with a rate of 51%. Child poverty rates are also high in other large cities like Birmingham and Manchester. The latest data available shows children from black and minority ethnic groups are more likely to be in poverty at 46% compared to 26% of children in white British families. Children's charities, schools, and food aid organizations are working tirelessly to plug the gaps created by the welfare system. Food banks are now being set up in schools so children have enough to eat.
Research by the Child Poverty Action Group earlier this year estimated that one in three school children living in poverty don't qualify for a free school meal. So when we talk about hunger, we're talking about children coming to school and relying on a hot, nutritious meal at lunchtime. And the figures around the one in three are sitting at around 800,000 children. And that's why we're running a campaign to extend eligibility so more families living in poverty can access good nutrition at lunchtime.
Living in poverty can have a serious impact on a child's well-being. Some report feeling ashamed and unhappy and worry about their parents. Disadvantaged children are more likely to develop severe mental health problems by age 11 than their well-off peers. Kids in inadequate housing have been shown to be more at risk of respiratory illnesses and meningitis. Those in the most disadvantaged areas can expect 20 fewer years of good health in their lives than children in places with more resources.
So when you're living in a cold, damp home, that causes huge problems. If you're in, if you've got pre-existing heart conditions, if you've got respiratory illnesses such as long COVID or COVID itself, if you've got asthma or COPD or other lung conditions, all of those things are made much, much worse by living in a cold, damp home. If you're recovering from surgery, that can take longer for your wounds to heal because you're living in a cold, damp home. So there's a whole range of different things that are affected by the problem of fuel poverty. And that's why if we don't solve these things through economic measures, we're going to see a long-term health crisis affecting our country.
On the rise alongside poverty is childhood obesity, with rates at an all-time high. Children aged 4 to 5 in the most deprived 10% of the population are 75% more likely to be overweight or obese than those in the most affluent 10%. Poverty even puts kids at greater risk of being groomed or exploited by criminal gangs. There are reports that children whose families are mired in deep poverty are stealing basic items such as food and tissues from their schools, and some are missing lessons altogether because they cannot afford the bus fare. In November last year, The Independent published a horrible report about schoolchildren and parents shoplifting to feed themselves and their families. Meanwhile, the Children's Society is warning that government support does not go far enough, as thousands of children are at risk of malnutrition this winter. Campaigners and economic experts have repeatedly called for an overhaul of the Social Security safety net, particularly reforms for universal credit and an end to the two-child limit to receiving some benefits. The 20-pound cut to universal credit in October 2021 plunged families back into poverty after giving them light relief throughout the COVID-19 pandemic. Surprisingly enough, successive Conservative Chancellor have reduced tax credits and benefits for low-income families with children, while introducing tax cuts that have benefited the better off.
We are calling the government to increase its support in order to get through this winter. And we are also calling the government to think about enduring solutions, especially in the area of energy efficiency, in order to reduce very significantly the level of consumption of our customers.
According to The Observer, the UK has become a hostile place to have children, as parents are being forced to bring their offspring in conditions that will have grave repercussions for society. It starts even before birth. It's estimated that more than 1,000 babies die or are left with severe injuries each year as a result of something going wrong during labor. Meanwhile, the number of child abduction offenses has been on the rise. Over the past decade, nearly 10,000 children have been abducted. In one case in late January, dozens of asylum-seeking children were kidnapped by gangs from a Brighton hotel run by the Home Office in a pattern apparently being repeated across the South Coast. It has emerged that the Home Office was warned repeatedly by police that the vulnerable occupants of the hotel, asylum-seeking children, who had recently arrived in the UK without parents or carers, would be targeted by criminal networks. Child poverty in the UK is reaching worrying levels. Paltry wages, low benefit payments, and a cost of living crisis mean the UK's poorest families and their children are getting poorer. But will the UK government do something meaningful in this regard? History is not promising, but we'll have to wait and see.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Researchers have discovered 15 particles of the contaminants per gram of vein tissue in the first study of its kind. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT noted in this regard, microplastics have been found for the first time in human vein tissue, a team of researchers from the University of Hull revealed last week. Five distinct types of microplastic were discovered in samples taken from the saphenous or leg veins of patients undergoing heart bypass surgery. We were surprised to find them, Professor Jeanette Rochelle said in a press release accompanying the paper's publication in the journal PLOS-1. He said, we already know microplastics are in blood, but it was not clear whether they could cross blood vessels into vascular tissue, and this work would suggest they can do just that. The UK-based researchers found an average concentration of 15 particles of plastic per gram of vein tissue, similar to or higher than the levels found in lung and colon tissue, but observed that the shape and types of plastic found in vascular tissue was markedly different from other tissue types. Rochelle observed, these first human tissue analyses suggest that the distribution of microplastics, predominant types, may be tissue-specific. The most common types of plastic found in the samples include alkyd resin, which is found in synthetic paints and varnishes, polyvinylacetate, an adhesive used in food packaging and shipping, nylon, and EvoEva, used for food packaging and watertight lamination. While Rochelle stressed that we don't yet know the implications of this on human health, she acknowledged that microplastics had been shown to cause inflammation and stress responses in lab settings. Co-author Professor Mahmoud Loubani added that the presence of the microplastics might contribute to the failure of coronary artery bypass surgery involving grafts from the saphenous veins, suggesting the contaminants may well play a role in damaging the inside of the vein, leading to it becoming blocked with the passage of time. Removing the microplastics was a possibility, he said in a press release. The team has previously discovered the ubiquitous pollutants in blood and lung tissue, as well as in surgical operating theaters. By some estimates, 15 tons of plastic waste enters Earth's oceans every minute, breaking down into smaller particles and entering the body through the food chain and through the air people breathe. Guardian had earlier reported microplastic pollution has been detected in human blood for the first time, with scientists finding the tiny particles in almost 80% of the people tested. The discovery shows the particles can travel around the body and may lodge in organs. The impact on health is as yet unknown, but researchers are concerned as microplastics cause damage to human cells in the lab, and air pollution particles are already known to enter the body and cause millions of early deaths a year. Huge amounts of plastic waste are dumped in the environment, and microplastics now contaminate the entire planet, from the summit of Mount Everest to the deepest oceans. People were already known to consume the tiny particles via food and water, as well as breathing them in, and they have been found in feces of babies and adults. The scientists analyzed blood samples from 22 anonymous donors, all healthy adults, and found plastic particles in 17. Half the samples contained PET plastic, which is commonly used in drink bottles, while a third contained polystyrene, used for packaging food and other products. A quarter of the blood samples contained polyethylene, from which plastic carrier bags are made. Our study is the first indication that we have polymer particles in our blood. It's a breakthrough result, said Professor Dick Vetok, and ecotoxicologist at Verige University in Amsterdam. He said,
But we have to extend the research and increase the sample sizes, the number of polymers assessed, etc. It is certainly reasonable to be concerned, he told The Guardian, adding, the particles are there and are transported throughout the body. He said previous work had shown that microplastics were 10 times higher in the feces of babies compared with adults, and that babies fed with plastic bottles are swallowing millions of microplastic particles a day. He said, we also know in general that babies and young children are more vulnerable to chemical and particle exposure. That worries me a lot. The research was published in the journal Environment International and adapted existing techniques to detect and analyze particles very, very small. Some of the blood samples contained two or three types of plastic. The team used steel syringe needles and glass tubes to avoid contamination and tested for background levels of microplastics using blank samples. Vetok acknowledged that the amount and type of plastic varied considerably between the blood samples. But this is a pioneering study, he said, with more work now needed. He said the differences might reflect the short-term exposure before the blood samples were taken, such as drinking from a plastic-lined coffee cup or wearing a plastic face mask. Vetok said, the big question is, what is happening in our body? Are the particles retained in the body? Are they transported to certain organs, such as getting past the blood-brain barrier? And are these levels sufficiently high to trigger disease? We urgently need to fund further research so we can find out. The new research was funded by Dutch National Organization for Health Research and Development and Common Seas, a social enterprise working to reduce plastic pollution. A recent study found that microplastics can latch on to the outer membranes of red blood cells and may limit their ability to transport oxygen. The particles have also been found in the placenta of pregnant women, and in pregnant rats, they pass rapidly through the lungs into the hearts, brains, and other organs of the foetuses. A new review paper published recently, co-authored by Vetok, assessed cancer risk and included more detailed research on how micro and nanoplastics affect the structures and processes of the human body and whether and how they can transform cells and induce carcinogenesis is urgently needed, particularly in light of the exponential increase in plastic production. The problem is becoming more urgent with each day.
Revolution of 79.